You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, this is the second instalment of the mini-series on addiction. And in this episode, I'm speaking with Jen Borster, who's a paramedic practice leader and advanced care paramedic in British Columbia, about what they have experienced on the streets of Vancouver in regards to addiction. So the title of the podcast is The Toxic Drug Crisis. And what we wanted to do with Jen is really dig into some of the complex issues around concomitant drug ingestion, the use of fentanyl, some of the complications of mental health, and the cyclical pattern of presentation in the pre-hospital environment for these patients. We're also going to explore the challenges of our biases towards this patient group and how that can affect both care and outcome. So I really enjoyed this conversation with Jen. She has got fantastic insight into this patient group. She has, as a paramedic practice leader, a portfolio that engages with paramedic-led research into both mental health, but also substance use and toxic drug crisis. So we dig in the episode to why we actually call it a toxic drug crisis in the first place. And it becomes apparent as you listen to the interview that a lot of these drugs are being mixed and indeed sold unknowingly to the people taking drugs without their knowledge of these really deadly concomitant drugs. So not just fentanyl, not just benzodiazepines, but some really toxic drug mixes, which is leading to profound difficulty in trying to reverse these drugs and indeed treat these patients. We also dig into some of the phraseology and indeed ways in which we can reframe our perspectives towards these patients, and also how we can potentially navigate and move these patients away from the emergency department into alternative care pathways. Please do enjoy this episode. In the third installment, we're going to be speaking about the psychology and psychiatry of addiction and what introduces people or starts people on the journey of addiction and what keeps them on the journey of addiction as well. Please do rate and review the podcast, and also please do give me your feedback. I always appreciate getting the emails and messages from yourselves. So without further ado, here's the wide-ranging conversation me and Jen had on the toxic drug crisis. Jen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Owen. Happy to be here.
I just wonder if we could just start with getting you to speak to the scale and size of the problem, or indeed the issues with the people who are ingesting and using these highly toxic substances in Vancouver and beyond into BC and Canada.
Yeah. In your introduction, you mentioned complex and challenging, and it's such an accurate description. In British Columbia specifically, since the provincial government announced a public health crisis related to illicit drug toxicity in 2016, 13,000 people have lost their lives as a result. And what that equates to today is approximately 6.8 or 7 people who are dying every single day as a result. And it is important to note that it's not just Vancouver or metropolitan and urban settings that we're seeing increased incidences of drug use and related mortality. What we're actually seeing is huge surges in our rural, remote, and Indigenous communities. And so as a paramedic organization and out of hospital care provider, our challenges are mighty in that we need to ensure that we're providing equitable care and meeting the needs and meeting the demands of communities that previously didn't require such a response. Now, the issue is obviously quite pronounced in British Columbia, but we know that Canada at a large is also experiencing huge surges in drug-related mortality. And in fact, today, 21 people are dying every single day across the nation as a result. And so the problem is mighty. The response required is going to be mighty. And paramedics and paramedic organizations are uniquely positioned to play a huge part in enhancing the patient experience in this setting.
So just looking at the mix of drugs and the challenges that paramedics are facing on the ground, could you maybe speak to some of the main drugs and maybe typical drug combinations that paramedics are seeing within BC?
Sure. So in BC specifically, prior to 2015, we're seeing between 10 to 15,000 drug poisoning events per year. In 2015, fentanyl entered the scene, where we started to see a huge surge in cases until around 2020, where we began to notice an immense spike in cases that has just been surging since. And so since fentanyl entered the scene in 2015, we began to see pronounced incidents of its analogs, so carfentanil, highly potent versions of opioids, in addition to contaminating substances that are non-opioid in nature. So benzodiazepines, xylazine entered the scene in 2020. We're seeing it more pronounced today in 2023. Xylazine, if you're not familiar with it, is an extremely high potent animal tranquilizer. It's used in veterinary sedation and anesthesia, and it's being found in the drug supply, and it's being found in a supply that might be counterfeit in nature. And so what I mean by that is that drugs are being sold as an opioid or as down, or in some cases they're being sold as a Xanax, a pill that looks exactly like a Xanax, that is virtually, you would not be able to not identify it between a prescription Xanax. Someone's taking that and they're dying. And that drug's being tested and found to have things like xylazine, benzodiazepines, and fentanyl in it. And so the complications in that are huge, not just for people who are using, obviously, but for people who are responding to drug poisonings, because not only are we seeing a very complicated resuscitation phase, things like prolonged sedation, complications of contaminated drug ingestion, such as vomiting and aspiration and things like this, but it also means that the recovery period following the resuscitation is much more complicated, and the challenges for paramedics on the front lines, they're obvious.
So you make a really good point there, Jen, actually. And I'd like to, before I ask the next question that I was going to ask you, I'd just like to pivot and just look at this sort of semantics, because I think it's really pertinent to highlight some of the semantics about drug poisoning and just the phraseology of poisoning, because absolutely to your point, it's an acute poisoning of the system. And also there is a large level of uncertainty and indeed kind of occult, so hidden kind of nature about what these people are ingesting. Could you maybe speak to the phraseology of poisoning for a second?
Yeah, and I'm so happy you brought it up, because language is so, so important here, and words really do matter. And so historically, we referred to this crisis as an opioid epidemic or an overdose crisis. And we're not referring to it as that anymore for a couple of reasons. The first is that we're not just dealing with opioids anymore. So why would we refer to it as an opioid crisis? The other is that there is a bit of a negative connotation associated with the word overdose, and that a person has taken too much. We know that that's not the case anymore. We know that people are taking very small amounts of substances or their usual dose of substance that they have always known to be one thing and to have an expected result, and they're being poisoned. And so the phrase poisoning there is important, because it takes out the negative connotation. It takes out the stigma associated with the word overdose, which might imply feelings of blame and shame, things that can cause a person to want to isolate, use alone, and be at much higher risk of suffering a drug poisoning. The other part of the phraseology there is the word unregulated. And so when we talk about this crisis, we're referring to it now as the unregulated drug poisoning crisis, because the drugs are so contaminated and highly unregulated. And there's a direct correlation there with the incidence of mortality that we're seeing.
So just looking at a couple of issues which have become more prevalent in what otherwise would be patient populations and or people populations that maybe weren't initially didn't have a proclivity to addiction. And something I saw within the summer in Canada, and I've seen this in North America in some of the EMS systems there as well, is these patients which have otherwise been on the sidelines of addiction, but actually have, what's happened is either through prescription use and the trickle down effect of maybe social deprivation, started to lose their grip on their normal normal life and sort of slid into a drug habit or a toxic drug habit. Could you maybe speak to sort of the atypical population that we're seeing now within this cohort?
Yeah, I think it's just really important to flag that no one is immune to substance use, addiction, and mental health. And obviously there's intersections there. There are things below the surface that a person, as in the self or the person that you may care about or the people in your life may have that they're not aware of. And so these are things like dormant mental health, environmental factors, genetic factors, generational genetic factors that may be at play that you're not even aware of until suddenly you're in a situation where you're suffering and the interplay between mental health suffering and self-medication is apparent. And so I think it's just really important to flag that nobody is immune. And so there's two things there. There's the kind of notion that no one is immune to the risks of falling into substance-dependent behavior, but also that the likelihood of being poisoned doesn't just exist for a person who is using what is typically known as hard drugs or harmful or, you know, drugs that people would normally associate with someone who is using on the street per se, which is a bit of a stigmatizing notion in and of itself. But to make the point, people who are more recreationally using cocaine in a party setting, for, you know, for example, someone who doesn't consider themselves substance addicted, substance dependent, but they're more of a recreational substance user. So people are using things like cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA in small amounts, and they're finding themselves in a drug poisoning situation. So to say no one is immune is to say no one is immune to be at risk for using substances, and no one is immune from ending up in a drug poisoning situation if they are using drugs that they may think historically would have been safe to use.
So really interesting you mentioned, and I'll bring this question forward slightly and just around mental health, because I think, like you said, there is an interplay of mental health and within maybe even a long-standing or short-standing or even a seminal moment within a person's life, which can contribute to a drug poisoning and or an addiction. But could you speak to what you see anecdotally on the ground from mental health and its sort of symbiosis with this community? Because it, as you say, it is a community of people, but also I saw a lot of loneliness. I indeed experienced a lot of loneliness myself, and actually trying to navigate loneliness and stay on the path and not veer off the path can be tricky, because that can be a concomitant contributor to addiction. Could you maybe speak to the interplay and what you see from it?
Yeah, I mean, we spoke to it briefly. It's what's important here is that we shouldn't be making determinations that a person who is along the spectrum of substance use, which can be someone who uses substances but doesn't necessarily experience things like dependence and addiction, all the way across the spectrum to someone who's maybe got moderate to all the way to severe substance dependence or substance use disorder, as they kind of have called it historically, an addiction. What's important there is that not all of those people are experiencing what is traditionally known as mental health issues or mental health challenges outside of substance dependence. But we know that there's a relationship there and that oftentimes one can exist with the other. It's important that the two different challenges are being treated separately. And it's important to recognize that substance use does not necessarily always cause mental health challenges, and mental health challenges do not always cause substance use. But we know that either or can put a person at risk for for the latter. And so when we talk about things that put a person at risk, our most vulnerable population is in our youth cohort. We know that people at that phase in life are at risk for challenges environmentally, psychosocially, et cetera. And those sort of things can put a person at risk for using substances. And an example of substance use and correlating mental health is the kind of accepted evidence around a person who might be experiencing a lot of marijuana use during their youth, and they're kind of they're more likely to end up experiencing things like schizophrenia later on. And so those are our kind of more vulnerable populations. And outside of that, what's really important to recognize is just that the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
So looking at the lived experience of drug use, something else I found very informative was people coming to speak to us, cohorts of paramedics in the summer with lived experience, and getting their first-hand account of coming back in and managing safe drug administration sites or testing sites, but also giving their anecdotal reflections from and it helped me, I think, remove some of my presuppositions and some of my biases that it can't, it just affects a single cohort, because these people were really genuine, really hardworking, and really changed, reframed my perspectives. But could you maybe speak to what you see from either the empirical literature or indeed your reflections from people with lived experience of drug use? What does sort of the qualitative data say about these people, and indeed how they can maybe educate paramedics and change our perspectives?
Yeah, so important. Well, I'll speak to both sides of it, from the literature sort of side and then my own anecdotal experience. And so I've been very fortunate in my role as a clinical manager with BCHS to engage in patient experience groups. And so we have three. We have a general patient experience group, a person with lived and living experience of mental health patient experience group, and then we have a patient experience group for people who have lived and living experience of substance use. And so because my portfolios generally include mental health and substance use, I sort of led the engagement process with those two cohorts. And I can't say enough how much organizational growth and learning has occurred through those engagement sessions. What is really important, I think, to flag is that we came to these sessions with these kind of program areas and guidelines and projects that we wanted to get feedback on. That was kind of the intention, was sort of this one-way stream of, here's what we're doing. Can you, you know, look at it and see if we're doing the right thing and review it. But where we found the most value in these sessions was actually opening it up to be more two-way. So not just us going to them with things that we wanted feedback on, but actually asking the cohort of people who have experience with emergency health services about what their experiences have been and how to kind of enhance those experiences. And really just allowing the group to come to us made it much more meaningful of a process. And so a great example of how important having that two-way stream is was the community really coming together as a whole and bringing up the kind of difficult conversation around 911 calling at a drug poisoning. So the traditional workflow would be that the person responding to the drug poisoning would call 911. They would be next to a person who's experiencing a drug poisoning, but they had a pulse. They just required ventilation and they required naloxone. And despite the caller telling the emergency medical call taker that the person had a pulse, the emergency medical call taker, to be compliant with their medical priority dispatch system scripts, would require them to do chest compressions. And so they would kind of end up in this loop of the person saying they have a pulse, they don't need chest compressions, and the the call taker saying, no, they do need chest compressions. And this was actually creating a bit of a negative interaction with the 911 system from the very beginning. It was causing tension, it was causing strain, and it was actually leading to a reluctance to call 911, which is what we don't want. And so we would have never been aware of this issue had they had not brought this forward, and we had not had the platform and the comfortability to have these kind of difficult conversations. So we took that away and kind of looked at what we could do while remaining a safety profile for the cohort of patients who may indeed be in cardiac arrest. And we just developed a script within the existing scripts that recognizes the experience and expertise of people who have lived and living experience working within overdose prevention sites, specifically in responding to drug poisonings in a safe way. And so just one small thing, but really monumental with respect to the building of rapport and trust between the 911 system and people who have lived and living experience that is really important. And so anecdotally, an extremely meaningful program that I really feel every healthcare organization needs to nourish and to be a part of. And then the other part of that is the literature, which is to say that in the last few years, there has been an emphasis in producing the opinions and perspectives of people who have lived and living experience on their healthcare experience specifically. But what is really lacking is the literature to support that experience in the pre-hospital setting or their experience with out-of-hospital providers. And so a few colleagues and I conducted a literature review earlier this year, and we found only two studies that incorporated but did not focus on the perspectives of people who have lived and living experience of substance use within that study and specifically towards paramedic care. And so it's a gap in the literature that needs to be addressed. It's the number one thing paramedic organizations should be focusing on right now is to better understand how our care is influencing a person's experience and a person's journey through the healthcare system.
So Jen, just pivoting slightly and looking at referral pathways and how we could maybe look at not looking at the archetypal or the standard referral pathway to the emergency department, how can we cater for this cohort of people in a different way?
Yeah, and this is another really important area that paramedic organizations need to focus on right now. In British Columbia, approximately 65% of people right now are not being conveyed to the emergency department following a drug poisoning. So when we take that and we apply that to what we know about 911 calling, which is to say that people are not calling 911 as frequently, what we're really seeing is a narrowing window of opportunity for paramedics to be able to offer alternatives to emergency department conveyance, because we know it's not the place that people often would like to go to in that post-drug poisoning phase. And we also know it's not necessarily the best place for them. But what we also know is that people who are not conveyed to the emergency department and connected in with care following a drug poisoning are at much higher risk of mortality in short, medium, and long-term settings. And so because of the frequency at which paramedics are encountering people who use drugs, we're really uniquely positioned to offer alternatives. And so alternatives include things like transporting a person to a site that is not an emergency department. So in British Columbia, what that looks like is paramedics having the opportunity to, instead of taking them to the emergency department, conveying them to a safe consumption site within their community, if that pathway has been established and that safe consumption site has the receptor capacity to be able to do that. Outside of our alternative conveyance pathways, we have our referral pathways. So this is something that can be offered to any person across the province. How that works is a paramedic will offer them to be connected in with an outreach team within their community if they do decide to stay on scene and not be conveyed to the emergency department. That's one of our assess, see, treat, and referral pathways, in which we have a few. The paramedic will take the person's information, complete the electronic patient care record. That referral is then sent to a central access point within the person's health authority. And from there, that team will send the referral to the team that is the closest to that person. Now, these teams are, I mean, they're incredible. The scope of what they can do and what they can offer seemingly has no bounds. Anything from offering peer support and networking, access to phones, access to housing, access to food, to more of our kind of medicalized type of therapy, such as access to opioid agonist therapy, and even opportunities to connect someone in with a clinic that offers things like safer supply of drugs.
So Jen, looking at the way we can reframe our perspectives with people struggling with either addiction or indeed drug poisoning, could you maybe speak to even the way we reframe our language, but also how we reframe our biases, and indeed the way we indeed treat people experiencing sort of toxic drug crisis or indeed a toxic drug poisoning?
Yeah, well, paramedics get into the business of helping people. And to simplify it, people who use drugs are people. And so this is just about humanizing and really putting an ethical, equitable lens on our care and not discriminating against a certain patient population. We refer to people who use drugs as people. So this is what's known as person first language. This is a really low hanging way to reframe the way we care about this patient population. So what paramedics can do today is just take a look at their language that they're using and kind of take a look at their approach. And so things like language include no longer using stigmatizing terms such as addict or substance abuse. It's just substance use, no longer saying substance abuse. And outside of language, it's about an approach. So when we talk about harm reduction, we're often talking about tangible items or things that we're offering people that reduce harm, but it's an approach. And when I say approach, what I mean is using things like language, slowing down a little bit, really enacting an empathetic approach. You know, paramedics are very used to responding to these drug poisonings. They're seeing them so frequently that they're almost drawing up naloxone as they're getting out of the ambulance, sort of thing. And they're really, really comfortable and confident in responding to the drug poisoning and handling the resuscitation. But where their kind of sentiments of uncertainty or lack of confidence is in that post-drug poisoning phase and this kind of system navigator phase where, you know, it does require a bit of a different approach and a different lens. And so we're just asking paramedics to really do their best to step out of that resuscitation mode, slow things down, get on the person's level, feel a pulse, but ask permission first and just start to have a conversation and see what kind of care planning can be done.
Really interesting you say that, actually, because I very much saw and see a lot of burnout, but also acute and chronic fatigue within the paramedic population, and very much was one of those paramedics as well for a long time before I had a bit of a circuit breaker. Yeah. And did something else, and actually, interestingly, have my own anecdotal experience of having some profound conversations with patients on reversing an insulin overdose and actually calling his dad, getting his dad to come visit him, and then looking at sensible referral pathways outside of the emergency department, because actually he needed his family around him and he needed a referral and a safeguarding referral, but it didn't need to be the emergency department here and now. But I think also what took me back was it was 4 o'clock in the morning on the fourth night shift. I was really tired, but also I remember having this conversation thinking, you are not like the other 10 people that I've just reversed an overdose with, albeit with insulin or heroin or something else. Everyone has got their own story. And this guy, literally, things had triangulated to conspire against him, as sometimes they do. And But I had that revelation that there's a person behind every 911 or 999 call. And it's just that realization that you've got to break the heuristic, you've got to break the bias. And I had to constantly speak to myself to see that, because I remember sitting back in my advanced paramedic car afterwards thinking, oh my gosh, like, he absolutely just needed family around him at that time just to get to steer him around, and a safeguarding referral as well. But it just caught me off guard as to how it really hit me quite personally, actually.
Yeah. And can we call something out for a moment? Paramedics weren't prepared for this. Certainly within British Columbia, paramedics were not talked to about the challenges of social work in the 911 setting. They weren't taught about the inner workings of addiction. There wasn't a lot of time spent on the physiology of acute withdrawal, even. And so paramedics are very well prepared to handle the resuscitation phase, absolutely. But there does need to be a shift in how we're preparing paramedics for the real world, not just so that they can take better care of patients, but so that they can be mindful of the toll that this is going to take on their own mental wellness. And so we know that paramedics are experiencing extremely high incidence of moral distress and burnout and lack of resilience. And so it is on paramedic organizations to be able to care for paramedics who are outside of the school setting and are already taking care of patients and kind of stuck in this cycle. And so I think that that's where there's this really unique opportunity to kind of provide this like synergistic harm reduction for not just patients, obviously, but for paramedics, by giving them more tools and options to be able to provide better care for people outside of just kind of ending up stuck in this cycle of taking someone to the hospital or leaving them on scene in acute withdrawal, and knowing that all along that isn't going to be the best end result for that patient in that context.
I'd like to ask you one or two more questions, Jen, about addiction and about this toxic drug crisis that they're facing. But I'd also like to pivot and look at leadership for a while, because you are a leader fundamentally within your organization, and looking at just how leadership has changed you as a person and how it's changing you. But just the final sort of question on drugs and addiction would be more so around just what are you doing corporately as an organization right now to prepare paramedics? Because quite rightly, as you said, actually, fundamentally, paramedics are counselors at point of contact. They are counselors. They're stewards. They're patient navigators, navigating the ecosystem for other patient advocates. They're many things to the patient. How are things changing? How indeed are you changing the landscape for paramedics to prepare them more appropriately for practice?
Yeah, well, it's not easy. And that's because the onus is on paramedic organizations to be able to deliver on subjects that aren't comprehensively covered in paramedic education. And so education is really important, for sure. So we have co-developed and co-designed certain education programs and courses for paramedics that address things like trauma-informed care, stigma, holistic models of care, and some of the kind of harm reduction tools that can be applied that paramedics can take. But we know that it's not just about education and courses. We do need to build a little bit more of a comprehensive knowledge translation strategy. And part of that involves, you know, being able to pull your membership and your staff and kind of figure out where paramedics are at. And so what that kind of looks like for me specifically is attending things like meetings, unit chief meetings or station meetings, going out and about, talking with paramedics, and just kind of creating a bit of a platform for them to feedback and their experiences and host those conversations. And I think the example I like to use is about 18 months ago when I first started in my position, we would be having conversations about the care of this patient population specifically. And there would usually be one or two people who would sort of challenge some of the things that I was discussing for whatever reason or purpose. And often it would require me to push back a little bit and challenge them. And, you know, a really, really good conversation would end up taking place. But what I'm seeing more frequently now is I'll end up in these situations where these conversations are taking place and a paramedic will say something. And instead of me being the person to challenge them, it'll actually be a different paramedic that's challenging them. And then I can just get to sit back and watch this conversation take place, which as a clinical leader is unbelievably rewarding to see, because that's culture change. And what we know about culture is that it takes a really, really long time to change. So measuring success in very small wins is important. But to my previous point, the onus on paramedic leadership and clinical medical programs and governance to be able to deliver programs for paramedics so that they can provide better care is also going to be extremely important in just creating more meaning for paramedics in that interaction. So things like putting take-home naloxone kits in ambulances, giving paramedics specific clinical practice guidelines and resources that they can access surrounding harm reduction are kind of low-hanging fruit areas that any paramedic organization can implement to better augment the care that their staff are providing.
Jen, how has leadership changed you fundamentally as a person and as a clinician?
Yeah, that's a big question. Well, I suppose the reason that I got into leadership was so closely tied to this work without myself even realizing it. So I was working on the downtown east side as an advanced care paramedic, and I was exposed to that high degree of human suffering every single day, really just stuck in this pattern. And I was left with this resounding sense of helplessness, which is so interesting because it's exactly what the qualitative literature surrounding the paramedic experience of the toxic drug crisis is saying. And so it was sort of in that cycle that I really became inspired to pursue opportunities within my organization that would allow me some leverage to advocate for some different models of care or programs that were tailored towards our more vulnerable and marginalized populations. So there's that. I think what I would really like to see as a leader is us being able to allow more streams and opportunities for frontline staff to be able to implement change within their organizations. And so I'm very fortunate in my role as a leader that I'm able to advocate and push and drive some of these things, but it really is the frontline voice that should be driving some of these things. And I had wished in my experience as a paramedic that I had some of those pathways. And so what I really love and what's really changed me as a leader is just the degree of optimism that I have, not just for this organization, but for the care that paramedics are able to provide for people who use drugs. And that's been inspired by the development of certain clinical governance committees that our chief medical officer, Dr. Mike Christian, has been able to implement, which has allowed the opportunity for paramedics to approach their local paramedic practice leads with a problem and be given the opportunity to write a decision briefing note and come up with a solution and actually be part of that change. It's so meaningful for paramedics. And I'll give you a really quick example. Obviously, I'm super passionate about this topic. There were two paramedics working within the Nelson community, which is in the interior of British Columbia. They were experiencing a surge in attended drug events. And one of those paramedics also volunteered at one of the local safe consumption sites. And so in her interactions with people in the drug poisoning setting, in addition to her liaising with people who worked within the safe consumption site, had decided that there might be an opportunity to create an alternative conveyance pathway here. And so those paramedics went to their local paramedic practice educator with this idea. Paramedic practice educator came to me. We all got together, had a meeting. I was able, through my access, to look at some of the data where we found that, by the way, there was one day during the week that this paramedic was experiencing this surge in events where 75% of 911 calls that day in that community were drug poisonings. Three quarters of the calls that day were drug poisonings. And that month they had hit a new record for drug-related mortality. And so because there's just one leader overseeing an entire provincial response, it can be really hard to be able to notice those local level challenges. And so how important is it that paramedics have pathways to be able to bring issues forward and also be part of the solution? And so in short, what's changed me is the degree of optimism that I have for the future. And I guess outside of the other kind of humility pieces of working so closely with vulnerable and marginalized populations, I guess I just have a kind of renewed sense of empathy and pride for the profession.
That's fantastic to hear, actually. And like you said, that sense of autonomy, Jen, where you can actually advocate for patients, but you can also advocate for paramedics, having been there yourself and having been, you know, on the downtown east side for so long. And that sense of agency as a leader to change the narrative, but also put educational content in there, you know, and just it's all incremental and it's all iterative. And, you know, sometimes when you don't feel like you shift the needle, my onboarding when I was working at BCEHS, I super valued someone coming in with lived experience who was undifferentiated to me or the person sitting next to me. Really shook me, actually, really made me think differently. And it's those learning moments which are hard to capture and hard to see as a leader because you're not present, but actually make so much of a difference and start to really re-course correct the narrative, the overall narrative. But as we come into land, Jen, could you maybe just speak to a few take-home messages for listeners that you'd like to mention in our approach to crisis such as this?
Yeah. I guess I would just ask that paramedics take time to reflect on their practice. Take an opportunity to perhaps challenge their preconceived ideas about substance use. Be really curious. Ask about if your care is equitable. And then, regardless of where you're working, really begin to ask questions and challenge your organizations if these programs don't already exist. You know, ask why these programs aren't, you know, in existence, and see what you can do to push and drive some things within your organization so that better care can be provided.
Yeah, that's fantastic and a fantastic place to leave it. I think what we'll do is we'll put in the show notes a few links to empirical papers and indeed studies on indeed the crisis and some of the emerging literature base, which is up and coming. But listen, thank you for your time, Jen, for the past 45 minutes. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, always really rewarding to be able to talk to the greater community about these things.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.